that I make. The other thing that I've learned that I need y'all's help with tonight is I learned last week that Stephen sleeps during my class, and I didn't know that. That was news to me. So if y'all could just glance periodically, I think it will make him uncomfortable enough.
Hey, speaking of Matt teaching next week, should we bring in more chairs?
You know, I was at Minute Maid last night, and they had standing room only, so I'm okay with people just coming and standing. I'm good with that.
Did you take out a second mortgage to do that?
I have a friend. I feel like I need to say that to people, because that's exactly, how do you preach and go to the World Series? I have a friend, okay? I can tell you I have not paid for a baseball ticket this year, so... but I mention that to you because I can still hear the buzz of the crowd in my ears tonight. So when I say to you, I can't hear you, I mean, like, legitimately, y'all will have to speak up when you weigh in tonight, because my ears are still ringing. I need you in Genesis 27. I'm going to go there in your Bible. Genesis 27. And let's pray together. It's a blessing, Father, to be in your presence and with your people, and to be in your word, and to think about your servant, Jacob. We pray that you would help us marvel at your story and to see the beauty and how the pieces are stitched together as we work together on that tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. So I'm going to put up our schedule real quick just to remind you of where we are here at the beginning of November. 1 month left to go, 3 classes counting tonight with a text talk in between there, which means we have, after tonight, 2 remaining classes for us to work on Genesis. And so, as I said, I'm out of town next week. Matt's going to be teaching class. And I'll cover whatever he doesn't cover. Is that a fair deal?
I guess that's the way it'll work out.
We'll see where I finish tonight, and then, yeah, and we'll divide at the end. But basically, folks, that is it. We're going to deal with Jacob and Joseph's story as we work our way through these 4 generations who get the Bible story started. As I mentioned to you already, the stories kind of overlap each other, so there's some subjectivity in the way that I've broken this out. But I think clearly, when you get to chapter 27, even though Isaac is still alive, Isaac is alive like all the way to chapter 35, okay? He is still around, but it is clear that he is in the background, right? If you read through this segment, this is a Jacob segment, even though Dad isn't going to die till we get to the end of it. And so that's why we identify him as the character here. Remember, too, as I was reading back through these stories, a lot of these are familiar stories if you grew up going to Bible class. We talk about them. And so what I'm hoping to do in the class is get us beyond the fact that, oh, yes, these are familiar stories. So remember, these are chosen stories. Of all the things that could have been shared about the life of Jacob, the Holy Spirit specifically selects these. One of the things that I think has been clear is that these are promise stories. Are you with me on that? You know what I mean? They're connected back to Genesis 12 and the promises God made to Abraham as we're building the second ark, as we're working up to telling the story of Jesus. So we're looking as we go through for the promise connections. What do these have to do with the promises and the bigger stories, or the bigger story, I should say? Let me put in as an aside at this point. As we stitch them together, notice familiar themes and the way the stories parallel each other. What happened to Abraham oddly sounds a lot like what happened to Isaac. And what happened to Isaac, it looks like the same kinds of things are happening to Jacob. I don't think that's just a curiosity or, you know, just coincidental. I think the stories are meant to sort of sound the same because the same kinds of things happen to them. That's one reason they're chosen. The other group of people we're thinking about as we go through here are the wanderers, remember? The people who are on the Exodus, because that's the time the book was written. And increasingly we've noticed there are things that seem to be chosen and placed because it would have been helpful to the Exodus crowd. And we'll work that in as well as we go through this tonight. So with that quick reminder, let's start walking through the Jacob stories. And we'll begin in 27 with that familiar story, if you grew up going to Bible class, of Jacob and his struggle to rip off his brother's blessing. You remember that story? Gist of it is? Go ahead and say something now. Did y'all not go to Bible class?
Jacob pretends Jacob's. To be Esau to get his blessing.
Jacob actually
covers himself with hair.
Yeah, there's a whole,
deceives his father.
Yes, but who's really behind that?
Mom.
Rebecca finds out that a blessing is going to be given, and she helps conspire with her son Jacob to steal the father's blessing. And so when I grew up going to Bible class, I came away thinking, well, Jacob is a sneak, and his mom isn't a lot better. The bad guys, the villains in the story were Rebecca and Jacob. And who's the poor victim in the story?
Esau and Dad.
Isaac seems like the one who got taken advantage of here. And Esau's kind of a punk anyway, so we're not very sorry for him along the way. So anyway, by the way, did we anticipate this, that there would be this kind of trouble? Why?
Because it told us before.
Yeah, back
in struggle already.
At chapter 25, the kids were fighting before they were born, right? And God says, yeah, that's what it's going to be the rest of their life.
Which is clearly a reason for Rebecca to have, like, you know, long-term bitterness towards her children.
Yes, but it seems more Esau-directed than Jacob-directed. Yeah, we were anticipating this. And by the way, the other thing we're anticipating because of the prophecy in 25 is who's going to win out in the struggle. Now, Jacob's going to end up on top in the struggle, so watch that as we go through the story. A couple of things, just big picture ideas to note as you read through this particular story in 27. The character of the boys who are now men shows itself. So basically the character of Jacob is?
He's a schemer.
He's a struggler. He's always trying to get ahead and get an advantage. Yes, sir.
I was going to say he's also a mama's boy.
He is a bit of a mama. Well, yeah, we do kind of have that going on.
He's a peaceful man living in tents, like he was a stay-at-home kind of guy.
Well, I always thought that Esau was kind of rugged and rough, and Jacob was kind of soft.
Yeah.
I see that way to you a little bit. But then he turns out to be an animal guy, a herdsman kind of guy. So then you kind of wonder about that. Favoritism is very present in this story. Watch for that, because that really impacts, that's the rest of Genesis. The favoritism winds its way through all the twists and turns of the rest of the Genesis story. The kids are going to learn it from mom and dad, and they're going to replicate it. What do we make of Esau as we read this story and the rest of this segment?
He doesn't think much about the future. He's hungry, so whatever it takes to get a bowl of food.
Yeah, kind of impulsive, melodramatic. I'm going to die. What parent has not heard that from their children? You don't feed me now.
Maybe he's a grown-up saying that. Like, I mean, I heard that when I was like 2.5 or 3. Yeah, 2.5.
Yeah, but some 20-year-olds are still 2.5. I mean, they're just still there. And he sounds like a child. A couple of other things that really come out about him is he breaks one of the cardinal rules of the patriarchs, and that is you don't intermarry. And he notices that it really aggravates his parents, and so he's like, let me go find some foreign women to get married to. It's an act of revenge against mom and dad. And then later, the Hebrew writer describes him as godless, so he's not a good guy. And that character trait plays out through the whole story. So let me talk a little bit. I remember beginning to try to work this section for the first time, and I wrestled with three ideas that are running through here. Of course, all the way through all of this, we're thinking about the promise, which when we think about the promise, we're talking about what?
Hope.
Great nation.
Yeah, this is Genesis 12. This is Abraham. So there is the promise that is at work. Then there was the birthright. And that goes back to chapter 25. And what is the birthright?
The oldest son got his double portion.
Yeah, so in that culture, there were responsibilities and privileges that came with being firstborn. That was known as the birthright. And that's what Esau sold in Genesis 25. And then there is the blessing. So in my mind, as I'm going through this section, I thought, okay, I got to get all this straight in my head. We got promise, we got birthright, and we got blessing. What is the blessing? Yeah, I was kind of wondering with all that too. Wasn't that the birthright? Are the birthright and the blessing the same?
No, they are not.
They're not. In fact, I know they're not because in verse 36, Esau gripes, "You've cheated me twice." When he finds out how Isaac has been deceived and how Jacob got the blessing, he says, "You've cheated me twice." I thought that was a bit of an exaggeration, right? Because no, he really sold it the first time. That's not really being cheated. But the blessing is something different. Yes, sir.
I don't know that this is correct, but this is how I've looked at it. The blessing was like being made the leader of the family kind of thing, where everything would flow through. Because as you watched this society as they moved on, the elder son got the bigger portion, but typically he also became sort of the leader of the family, and that was where I think the blessing kind of came in. He was now recognized as the leader, and I think that's what Esau was complaining about here. Not only did he lose his birthright, but now he's lost his ability to lead the family.
You know, in my mind, I tried really hard to sort of pull these apart, but there is an intertwining of them. For example, in verse 29, Esau's blessing is, "May you be the master of your brothers." Mm-hmm. So, but yet that was also part of the birthright.
Yeah.
So maybe my efforts to kind of pull them apart are going to ultimately be unsuccessful. Now, do the birthright and the blessing have anything to do with whether or not the promise flowed through you?
Apparently.
Does it?
Over the course of history, it didn't play out that way.
Isn't that odd? Because, see, that was my thinking. I was thinking, well, firstborn, you get the birthright, you get daddy's blessing, and the promise flows through you. In fact, biblically, that almost never happened, right? Who was firstborn in Jacob's family?
Reuben.
Do your tribe. Yeah, Reuben. Who did the promise flow through?
Judah.
And in the case of Jacob and Esau, in fact, who did we find out was going to be on top from the beginning? Go back to 25, before they're born. God says the older is going to serve the younger. And so already there were hints that this is not going to go the way that it typically goes. Now, would you factor back in the parental favoritism? Because now that becomes really important. How did the favorites play in Jacob's house? How did that work?
Mom favorite.
Yes. Esau was Jacob's favorite. Isaac's favorite. Jacob is Rebecca. So you got Isaac and Rebecca, mom and dad, and mama loved Jacob, daddy loved Esau. So I think that's important because I think actually what's really happening in Genesis 27 is not a scheme by mama to get her favorite the blessing. I actually think this is a scheme by daddy to bypass God and get his favorite the blessing. Back up to 25. God has already indicated how this is going to happen. And Esau is not happy. I'm sorry. Isaac is not happy about that. He wants Esau to be the child who gets the promise. And so notice typically when dads gave, okay, there are a whole lot of weird things about this blessing. First of all, the blessing happens right before you die. Is Isaac about to die?
No.
Not for a long time, guys. It's going to be years down the road. So I don't know if he was having a bad day or being sick or if he wasn't really close to death, but that's kind of what he says. The other thing is that when fathers bless their son in that culture, how many of the sons got a blessing?
All of them.
When Jacob calls in his sons at the end of Genesis, he's going to bless every one of them. Though some of them are hard to understand as blessings, nonetheless, everybody gets something, right? So, he doesn't call in Jacob. This is a private matter between him and Esau. And I think what Jacob is trying to, or Isaac is trying to do, they're going to mess me up with the whole class, Troy. I think what Isaac is trying to do is say, I'm going to pull a fast one on God, and I'm going to get the blessing for Esau. How does that work out?
It doesn't.
Providentially.
Well, it works out the way God wanted it.
It works out exactly the way. By the way, this is a great story to remember for everything through the Old Testament. God can even use wicked people doing wicked stuff to work out his plan. And that's exactly what he does here. And so, oddly enough, when you really kind of get underneath the story of what's happening here, it is not really Rebecca and Jacob who are bad guys, although pretty much everybody's a bad guy in this story. The real culprit here is Isaac trying to bypass God. And the lesson to take away is, hey, God's already got a plan for his promise, and you can kind of connive with that, but it ain't going to work. His plan will be worked out his way. So I've ruined the story of Jacob's deception. It really ought to be slick Isaac, not deceiving Jacob, going on. Yes?
Well, when they were born, what did he call it, the planter?
Yes.
So doesn't that imply an active role by him?
Hence, no good guys in the story. I am with you on that. And by the way, that will too be patternistic in the Bible story. We rarely deal with guys who are just completely good guys. And then sometimes God's dealing with people. Like, haven't any of y'all been bothered by Samson?
No.
I mean, Samson is not a good guy, not in any way. And yet, there's stuff going on between him and God is using him. And so, very early as God is developing his story, one of the lessons we learn is, I don't need you to be a good guy to use you and to accomplish my purposes. And in this story, you're not going to pull a fast one on me. I'll still work this out my way. Okay? So, all of this is promise stuff and how God is working out his promise. Moving on to 28. This is another interesting thing. It's kind of patternistic through the stories we've been looking at. And that is Jacob now is being sent away. Have we seen this kind of thing before? One of the sons being sent away. Ishmael was sent away as they're making clarity of who the heir is. Anybody else? Who's being sent away now? Yeah, it's kind of reversed though, right? And yet I wonder if it's kind of about the same thing. Remember, Ishmael sent away Abraham's other children to Keturah. Remember, they were also sent away. So there was clarity about who the heir was. Now, I don't think we're trying to get clarity about who the heir is here in 28, but we are trying to prevent what? Why is Jacob going away?
Esau wants to kill him.
Yeah, so Esau will kill him, right, and we'll keep the heir alive. That's exactly right. So same kind of a deal. It's just kind of reversed in this case. And so in 28, we got two things going on. Isaac is going to say something, and then God is going to say something. If you look at 1 through 9, Isaac basically says, don't marry the women of the land, and the promise is flowing through you. And so now he's been forced to accept what was God's plan all along. And then we have that dream beginning in verse 10, Jacob's dream. Notice, Jacob's little foray away from the family is going to be bookended by two kind of strange events. The first one is this dream that he has. And basically in the dream what happens is God rehearses the promise with him. So Isaac said it, and then God says it. So that by the time we get to the end of Genesis 28, now we've had it firmly established. It began with Abraham, it flowed through Isaac, and now Isaac has had two sons, and God has established that it will flow, the promise will flow through Jacob. Okay, with me? All right, 29 through 31, we're just going to call this Jacob and Laban. This is such a fascinating period of his life. There's so much fun to be had with this little section. It just was hard to kind of whittle this down to what we'd talk about and what we wouldn't. We've already met Laban. Laban is who?
Rebecca's
brother. So that would make him Isaac's brother-in-law, Jacob's uncle. And we've already established something about Laban. Do you remember?
Sneaky.
Sorry?
Sneaky.
Yes, we said he was a snake. Evidence of that early in 24 when they go looking for a wife for Isaac. And now if you ever doubted that he was a snake, it's about to really become crystal clear these next three stories, next three chapters. That's exactly right. Now, some important stuff. I started to call this good stuff, and I struggle to do that. But some important stuff, promise-related, happens during the Laban period of Jacob's life. Can you help me identify some of that? These three chapters, what's some of the important promise stuff that happens?
Well, he was promised, was it not Leah, but who's the other one?
Rachel.
Okay. So you're alluding to the fact he's going to get married.
Yes.
In fact, he's going to come out of this with how many wives?
Two wives.
I'm calling them wives. Okay. We're just going to call them wives. If y'all want to have the whole multiple marriage discussion, we're going to do it outside of class because that's at least four classes, right? So wives times four. And from the wives during this period,
12 sons,
one daughter. It would have been easier just to spell her name. So we have kids that come out of all of this, right? And then the other thing that you'll notice in this section is that he prospers. By the time we're done, he is a really, really rich guy. By the way, think about the other stories. Same thing happens to Abraham, same things happen to Isaac. They prosper. By the time he gets done, he's a very, very wealthy man. So that's kind of how his life develops during this period. There's also some really troubling things that happen to him in this period. Can you tell me about some of those? We'll just kind of skim through that.
He's met his match, and his uncle gets him to marry his first daughter before he marries the one actually he was supposed to marry.
You know, I had never thought about the fact that they're both schemers.
Yeah,
you are exactly right. It is like Jacob meets the king of schemers when he runs
actually,
up.
Actually, Jacob winds up on top.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that, and we'll get to that. That's a really important point. So it happens early when he is tricked about the wives. I will tell you that for me, it's one of the most bizarre Bible stories ever. That he works 7 years to marry young, beautiful Rachel, and on the wedding night,
behold, it was Leah.
Jeff's favorite passage in the Bible. If I had a dollar for every time Jeff said to me, behold, it was Leah, I don't know why he's hung up about that passage, but he quotes that again and again. So actually, I think there's a little karma going on there, right?
Yes.
Under the cover of darkness, he is deceived.
It's a parallel to the whole thing they tried to pull.
I think God's giving him his comeuppance and making it.
I mean, God's a funny guy.
Well, he does. He gets a little taste of his own medicine, and he's deceived, and so he winds up. I want y'all to think about this. Because this is just. I read this story and I think, what a train wreck this guy is. He ends up married to two sisters.
Yeah, that'll go well.
Nothing else needs to be said, right? But that's never not done, because one is beautiful.
One not so much.
Only.
One is beautiful. That's what I'm saying about that.
The other has a good personality.
Not even that. She didn't even seem to have that.
Okay. There's nothing redundant.
Actually, I will tell you. Y'all want a little advance notice, and you'll have to run with me because I'm going to put this out there and stick you with it. Liam winds up being the hero in this. That's the beautiful thing of this. In fact, I'll steal this from you so you don't have to say this.
I've written a hymn about Liam.
You've written a hymn about it. I won't ask you to sing it. But it's Leah that winds up buried with Jacob in the end. Right. Mm-hmm. So the struggle between the wives the whole life, Leah ultimately wins that struggle, which is interesting. But nonetheless, so you have these two sisters, one is beautiful, married to the same guy, and then the other thing about this family is favorites. Always play favorites. So you would think Jacob would at least be smart enough to be fair in his treatment of these two sisters that he's married to, but no, mm-hmm. He plays favorites. And so the animosity of this family just explodes, and then there's birth drama, right? Because it's a patriarch, and if it's a patriarch, we have to have birth drama. And in this case, what happens?
Rachel is
barren. Leah has kids. Rachel doesn't. You start trading maids and more wives, and they start reproducing. Wow, just crazy. And in the middle of all of that, what's the other problem he's dealing with? Huh?
The fight over the sheep.
Yeah, the whole Laban factor.
Yeah.
I mean, he can't go to work during the day because he's dealing with the snake, and he comes home and he's dealing with the two battling sisters. You wonder why the guy didn't walk off into the desert and never come back. By the way, another patriarch who has issues with herds and getting along with his local herdsmen, like Abraham and Lot did, like Abraham and Isaac both had with Abimelech. So you see the kind of repeated themes that are running all the way through this. So interesting segment as his life begins to come together here. Connection to the promises, I think, is present through these three chapters. Especially, what promise is getting work in this segment? Think about that. What promise to Abraham is getting some major advancement in this segment? The nation promise. That's right. Because think about how the nation promise has been teetering, like on one person not dying, right? We needed Abraham not to die because he didn't have an heir for a long, long time. And that played out. And then he had a son with Sarah. And then for a while, it was just like that until finally, well, we have two, Jacob and Esau. But now, 12 sons who are going to become?
The 12
tribes of Israel. That's exactly right. So the foundation stones of the nation are born in this segment of Jacob's story. The other promise I see at work here is that blessing or work promise, a blessing and curse promise that we talked about early, that I said is more prominent than we realize, because Laban discovers he needs to keep Jacob around, because with Jacob around, what happens for him?
He gets rich.
Yes. Everything he touches prospers. Because I will bless you. That was one of the promises. And Laban sees that. And so when Jacob gets ready, though Laban is kind of weird about that, instead of being really nice to Jacob like Abimelech did to his father, he kind of harasses him and gives him a hard time and manipulates him to get him to stay. When Jacob finally does leave and Laban's mad and comes after him, what does God say?
Leave him alone.
Yeah. Don't mess with him or it will be bad for you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And so the blessing curse promise, I think, is playing through this part of the story. By the time we get to the end of 31, he has made his peace with Laban, and he has gone back, and God had told him, started heading back to Canaan. But it's like out of the frying pan into the fire. because when he goes back to Canaan, he has to deal with
Esau.
So 31 and 32, we come back to the Jacob and Esau story. Why is this a problem, going home to see family? We'll all be doing that in 2 weeks, right? Why is this a problem? Yeah, remember that when he left, Esau's word was, when I get the right time, you're dead. I'm going to kill you. And if you guys are right, because y'all been real judgy about Jacob and Esau, that Esau was kind of strong and mighty and Jacob was kind of a weakling, this wasn't going to work out too well with him. So he does some things to prepare for this regathering of family. Y'all do some of this too around Thanksgiving, right? How are we going to make everything nice so everybody believes? So tell me, let's walk through 32. Talk to me about how he gets ready for the meeting with Esau. He does some stuff.
Well,
so
one thing, he splits up the camps. I'm sorry.
Yes. Before that, he does something, though. Hold that thought. Let me come back to that.
He separates the...
Before that, he does something.
He sends messenger
and he announces his coming. We're not just going to show up at the gate one day. We want, and I needed to get this detail in because his servants go and say, your brother Jacob is coming. And Esau's response is,
let's get all the troops out on camels.
Gather 400 men, let's go meet my brother.
Yeah.
The servants come back and say, your brother's coming with 400 men.
Yes.
And Jacob tells himself a story. What is the story?
He's going to kill me.
He is coming to slaughter me. That is exactly right. So that leads to, okay, I need to divide up the family here, put the entourage into two companies. The thinking about that was what?
Let him kill the ones I don't like so much.
So there is some favoritism. I wonder if he said, well, I'm going to let y'all go first in line, right? Yeah. I think, so one of the things to pay attention to is that Jacob plays favorites and the family knows, and it is a problem. It is a growing problem. So he creates his two companies with its favorites most protected. Then he prays to God about all of this, and then he sends gifts ahead of him to Esau, thinking if he's mad, the gifts will appease him. And so all these preparations are going on until the night before, where this starts getting really interesting, because literally everyone has gone ahead of me. I think it's interesting that he's in the very, very back. So maybe that comment y'all made about him kind of being a wimp, maybe that is true, and we're seeing it here. I don't know. He stays behind. He's completely alone. Question, how do you think he's feeling?
Scared.
Terrified.
Yeah, because? Why is he terrified?
Esau is stronger.
He doesn't know what's happened to...
Which means possibly what tomorrow?
Death.
Yeah, so I want y'all to think about that. Maybe some of y'all have actually been there. I remember a year ago, January. 2 years ago, January. My dad was having open heart surgery during the middle of COVID. And so I got to go sit with him in a hospital the night before his surgery. And so we're having this conversation about our mortality because it's a pretty serious surgery. Maybe you've been there. You know, sometimes when I have to go get a shot the next day, I ponder my mortality. I do not like shots a lot. So anyway, that's what he's doing in the night. He is wrestling with his anxiety and what's coming. And sometime during the night, he is set upon by someone that he fights with all night long. Doesn't the story just get weird? Mm-hmm. It's like, was he drinking or something? What was going on? This is just such a bizarre, wild story. And so they struggle together all night long until whoever it is that he's fighting with touches his thigh and suddenly he can't move anymore. You'll have to decide what you think about that. I don't think that this was, you know, some intense wrestling and his hip got dislocated. I think a miracle performed. And evidently, Jacob picks up on the fact that this is something special along the way. And so the guy says, let me go. And he says, not till you bless me. And what does the guy do instead of blessing him?
He renames him.
Yeah, he changes his name. Because they're always changing names in the Bible. Isn't that interesting? He changes his name. And so then Jacob asked the guy his name. The guy didn't give him an answer, but instead he gives him a blessing. So once again, notice Jacob is struggling for a blessing. That just seems to be the story of his whole life. So it is a weird story to start with. And then God saved it for us. So I'm thinking, what in the world does that mean? So what question do you have when you read that story about this struggle?
Why?
What was the purpose of it? What else do you wonder about?
Metaphorical. Metaphorical. Israel's going to struggle.
Let me hold on that. There are other curiosities. What other questions would we have about the story?
How did God become a man or put on a man suit?
Why say it's God?
Well,
this version does.
Some versions say that, some say that.
So who is he struggling with? That's actually a mystery.
Who else would he be asking for a blessing? He must have thought it was God. Why would he be asking for a blessing?
Or someone special anyway, not just an ordinary man, although in verse 24 he's called a man, whoever this is. But verse 30 seems to indicate that Jacob believes it's God. I agree with you about that.
But if it is God, I'm sorry, if God and I get in a wrestling match, it's not going to last very long.
But wait, yeah. Because Hosea says, I don't think y'all have enough to concern yourself with. Because when Hosea retells the story, Hosea says it's an angel.
So, one thing that bothers me, I don't know if that's the right word, one thing that is interesting to me is Jacob is not in character here. Everything we have seen about character is he hides, he averts, he puts other people in front of him, he doesn't want to fight, everything that we've seen about him up to this point is everything about avoidance of conflict. And yet in the story, he goes head to head with this, whoever it is, all night long, and refuses to give up until he gets what he wants. Completely out of his character.
Or is it? He wrestles for the blessings, doesn't he? And he's after that here? Yes, sir.
Well, two things. You have the men that visit Abraham, and Abraham carries on a conversation with them. And the second thing is maybe this Esau thing was a come-to-Jesus moment for him, where he changes his character and outlook on life.
Y'all are pressing me forward, and that's good, because I want to talk about what I think the point of the story is. I do think whoever this is shrouded in a bit of mystery. I lean toward the angel of the Lord, and I will leave you to wrestle with what you think it is. I've wondered, though, if it's meant to be shrouded in mystery. So maybe it helps us read the story as Jacob experienced it. Think about that. I mean, it just sounds the way the story reads that he was set upon and at least at first doesn't really know. In fact, his thinking, I think, evolves over the struggle about who that is, which is fitting for what I think the point of the story is. Jacob has always wrestled and struggled largely by his own power to get what he wants. But curiously, if you go back and read the Laban stories, there are just crystal clear indications in the story. Like that whole drama with how his sheep do better. Isn't it just clear that the hand of the Lord is in that? I mean, even Laban realizes the Lord is with him. So in his struggle with Laban, what gave Jacob success?
God.
The Lord did. And so I think the whole incident is sort of meant to communicate, you have wrestled your whole life. What you need to do is learn to let God wrestle for you, to depend on him, to let him fight the struggle rather than depending on yourself. I think he's figured that out. And I think the lesson that God is trying to teach him here is remember your lessons from Laban, and they're going to help you with what you're facing. Did you want it on that? Yeah.
Yeah, I just kind of want to say the same thing in a different way. If you look at all of this story up till now and even going into Jacob's sons and what they'll face here, you have this constant reminder that Israel, you people that are wandering around in the wilderness right now, Israel, you didn't get here because of yourself. You didn't do anything to deserve to be here. And in fact, most of the things that you've done were kind of crummy, right? Like, so really the only reason that you're in this situation is because of who God is, not because of who you are. And over and over and over again, we see that,
yeah.
You know, we have even the oldest is always being usurped by the younger. I mean, you know, Ishmael, Esau, we mentioned earlier, you have Joseph will usurp all of his older brothers. You know, Judah usurps, you know,
yeah.
it doesn't pay to be the oldest son ever in this whole thing. And it goes all the way back to, you know, Cain and Abel,
yeah.
Right? And it's this constant retelling of the same story. You didn't get here because of yourself. You got here because of me.
And so think about the wanderers. Remember I told you we need to keep thinking about the Exodus people who read this, who are coming out of the wilderness into Canaan. Jacob's coming out of the wilderness into Canaan. And Israel's going into a land to face a far superior force. Jacob is terrified that he's going up against his brother's 400 men, and we are going to be slaughtered. And God says to him, well, what does Israel mean? That's his new name. What does the name mean?
God
fights. So from supplanter, his new name is God fights. Think how much the wanderers needed to hear that message. Don't be afraid to go to the land, even against a greater army, because you are Israel. God fights. He will be your leader. He will be your savior. You see it? So I think there's a story that's been placed here for the wanderers to consider. Because when we get to 33, what happens?
Jacob seems to have learned his lesson because although they're all in line, he puts himself forward.
Yep. Oh, and if you read his prayer,
he goes for
it. If you read his prayer, he clearly, I think, has learned to trust God. I think the struggle is meant to remind him that he has learned that God will struggle for him. And how does it turn out when he meets his brother?
He's so good. He didn't have anything to worry about.
Okay.
Doesn't that happen all the time?
Yep.
Haven't you ever gotten completely stressed out about a meeting happening tomorrow, and you go into the meeting, and it was like, oh, it was all cool, no problem. And you fretted for nothing? Exactly how the story works out here. I am intrigued by his insistence that his brother take his gifts. Because Esau turned them down, right? I'm good. I don't need anything. I got plenty. No. Take the gifts.
I think this is more haggling like we saw with Abraham and Ephron.
You think?
Yes. That this is...
The way they did things?
Yes. This is Esau taking the bribe to leave Jacob alone that he was always going to take.
I have wondered, too, if there's some guilt on the part of Jacob for what he stole.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying.
And maybe he's saying, let me give back some of what should have been yours.
Although Jacob's career is not really characterized by remorse.
Well, and he refers to himself several times as his servant, too. So
yeah.
He shows some humility, even though he's the birthright and the blessing.
Yeah. And far be it for me to argue with Matt, though we have a long history of that. Neither man is acting in character at this point. Esau's a punk, but he doesn't kill his brother. He receives him back. And so I will leave you to wrestle with all of that. The other interesting thing that takes place toward the end of 33 is the quibbling about travel arrangements, which seems odd. Have you noticed the fuss going back and forth? Esau says, well, here, I'll go with you with my men. And Jacob says, no, we're good. We're good. And he said, well, I'll go ahead, but I'll leave some guys. No. We're good. We don't need you to go with us. Why is that recorded? Why is that preserved for us?
I think it's because they had, in God's plan, they really need to be separate. They didn't need to be. They did not need to be commingled together.
I actually think you're right. I do think this is about them not being together. Because the truth is, Jacob says, "I will follow behind," but he never does. Because Esau goes to Seir, and Jacob goes where? Canaan. God had sent him back to Canaan. And so that's where he goes. You could speculate about why he's not just straightforward with Esau about that. I'm thinking, after just settling with him, I'm not going to go back and say, oh, by the way, the promise goes to me, and I have to go to Canaan, sorry. Maybe it was just avoiding an awkward moment. But the cool thing is, the story ends, now Jacob has dealt with his two great adversaries, right? Laban and his brother. So everything's good, right? Yeah, then we get to, I think we have time to do this, we've got 5 minutes, we can do this real quick. Then we get to the assault on his daughter, Dinah. So in 34, if you look ahead there, in the first four verses, we're told that Dinah goes and visits the daughter of the land, and that's how this trouble starts. There is some suggestion, though we would not read it this way, that there was a propriety issue involved here, that she may have been kind of pressing the limits in her actions. While she's doing that, she catches the eyes of Shechem. The best read I have on Shechem is that he is a spoiled, self-indulged rich kid who just is used to getting what he wants. And in this case, what he wanted was Dinah. And so he takes her and rapes her. And though oddly, doesn't move on. He decides he wants her, so he does what spoiled rich kids do. He demands that his father make an arrangement. Interesting part of this story is what follows in verse 5, where there is a negotiation about this. On the surface, there appears to be this sort of cordial negotiation. What is important is what is not on the surface, because there's a whole lot underneath this that is really the important thing in the story. So on the surface, Hamar, Shechem's dad, sits down and says, hey, why don't we have our kids get married? In fact, why don't all of us intermarry? And there'll be great financial advantages, yada, yada, yada. And Jacob says, that's fine, but we got some religious issues. And he turns from economic to religious things and says, you guys would have to be circumcised because it would just be dishonorable for us to marry with you folks if you're not circumcised. Two things going on, though, that are not on the table in that negotiation. Number one, Jacob's sons are mad. They're enraged by this. Pay attention to the fact that Jacob's not. And the other thing that's really important is verse 26 makes clear that Hamar negotiates while he is still holding Dinah. That's really important. That's an important card in negotiation, where you actually have the girl in your possession. And so it sheds a different light, at least initially, on the story. I think that this starts as a rescue mission, which we would all say, what? How do you feel about that? Perfectly appropriate. Our molested daughter is being held captive. What we're going to do is we're going to lure them into a trap. Boy, how they agreed to the circumcision thing, don't even get me started on that. I don't know any idea how they agreed to that, but they did. And that provided, am I being delicate enough about this, an opportunity a couple days later while still in recovery for Simeon and Levi to come into the camp, verse 26 says, and to take Dinah. Are you good with that? I mean, I'm actually content that they suffered greatly while the brothers come and take their sister back home. But that isn't where it stops. Because then they kill every male. And then they loot the city. And what starts out is what seems to be a rightful act of rescue for the daughter becomes an act of greed and excessive vengeance. The interesting thing in the aftermath of this, and this is the part I want you to see, is it really exposes the divide that's taking place in this family. When Dinah is taken, verse 5 specifically says that Jacob says nothing about that. And the brothers, they are outraged, right? And when Simeon and Levi go and rescue her and then kill all the people, Jacob is angry about that, but why is he angry?
Now we can't stay here.
You're going to make trouble for me with the people of the land. Okay, are any of y'all getting bothered about this? What should Jacob be mad about? Why are you not upset about your daughter? In fact, listen to the listen to the language of verse 31. The brothers talk about our sister and not
your daughter.
What do you hear? His family is divided because of Jacob's partiality. And there is a deep-seated resentment here because of that. Why is that important? Why are we emphasizing that?
It's only going to get worse.
That's the rest of the story, yeah. Folks. Is your mind flashing forward to who?
Joseph.
Whose kid is Joseph? Rachel's. The Rachel's favorites, right? Favorites. Yeah. Yeah. And Benjamin. Benjamin can't go down to Egypt, right? The family division is still there that will lead to Joseph's being sold into slavery. And the family ultimately, in the by the time the story's over, down in Egypt. So all this little stuff that's happening along in here, there are messages here about what's going on in the family because that maps out the rest of the story for us. So, Matt, chapter 35, right?
Yep.
I'll let you pick up there. And go as far as you want.
Okay.
Or not. Preferably get out of 35.
We will discuss.
And so what I would encourage you guys to do is to be thinking ahead. I'm sure he'll get at least a little bit into the Joseph story. So 35, 36 was some of the reading for today. Look on ahead into Joseph's story. I'm sure he'll cover 38.
Yes.
Yeah. Read at least 35 to 38 for next class, and then we'll finish with Joseph in our final class. Thank y'all.